From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Once upon a time, the internet was heralded as the great equalizer across class, the harbinger of freedom, openness, transparency, and democracy. And during moments like Occupy Wall Street or the Arab Spring revolts, that seemed almost true. But today, revelations about pervasive government spying exposed through Edward Snowden's leaks and election interference by outside actors in the US's 2016 elections has left many of us with far less confidence about the internet's ability to make the world better. Although our ever-improving digital technologies were supposed to erase social and economic divides, it seems as though the internet simply reinforces such divides. Can we strengthen people's power through the internet, or should we foist our requirements of justice and equality onto the internet in order to make it work for us? My guest is Ramesh Srinivasan. He's the director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of information studies and design and media arts at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's the author of Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. And his new book, co-authored with Adam Fish, is called simply After the Internet. Welcome to the program, Ramesh.
Hi, Sonali. How are you? It's nice to see you again and speak with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So it's true that many of us have had sort of our confidence shattered in the ability of the internet to be this great equalizing force. And one of the things that, especially today, this notion of fake news, how to tell an ad by a sincere activist organization versus some nefarious Russian, you know, hacker on the other side of the planet trying to influence our elections. Who's watching us? Is it the NSA or is it, you know, marketing companies? When you search for one particular item on the internet, it suddenly shows up in ads all over. And it feels like we're constantly being watched and our views are constantly being shaped by outside forces, or we fear that they're being shaped by outside forces. So is the internet broken?
Well, in its current form, what we have is a massive centralization of power over how we get the information that we see, who controls the information that's gathered about us, and how that information can be used. So while the internet itself is a decentralized network on a technical level, right? Like the packet switching of data or the opportunity to create your own web page and have that in theory be found, there are platforms which are corporate and dominant, near monopolies, if not monopolies themselves, that are controlling our experiences of how information is gathered about us, how it's monetized, how it might be used politically, and what we end up seeing, which we know on a psychological level very much fundamentally shapes our minds and our awareness of what exists, right? So this is a profound centralization of power over the supposedly decentralized democratic world that we were all really excited about when it came to the internet. So we need to figure out ways to take it back, and that's what the book is about.
So in those moments that I mentioned, such as Occupy Wall Street and the Tahrir Square protests in Cairo, Egypt, was that the heyday of the internet, you know, between its formation and this particular moment? Was that around the time when the internet was just in that evolutionary phase where it became easy to use, easy to harness, but still not completely controlled by the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world?
Sure. I mean, what I argue is actually this sort of idea of the internet being a community-oriented space, a grassroots-created and managed infrastructure or set of environments that we could create in our own communities. They even used to use the word tribe to describe what people would do in relation to the internet. Those are much earlier days than the stories of 2011 in Tahrir Square or the Occupy movement, you know, shortly thereafter. These are earlier stories where the internet, this is really an incredible thing to realize, the internet, no commerce or commercial activity was even permitted on the internet till, you know, I know this is a long time ago, till the late 1980s. So it was actually really a fundamentally oriented community network. It was about the ideas of community, which in many senses we feel a sense of loss around in the United States with a sort of sense of civic disinvestment. So the internet as it stands right now is optimized for commerce and economic data analytic activity. It's not optimized for the logic and the constructs and the principles of community-based engagement.
Right,
and
so that, just as we found it to be an effective tool, corporations found it to be an effective tool to make money, and I suppose we shouldn't be surprised.
It is the most lucrative infrastructure that's delivering the most amount of money, revenue, and power to perhaps the most powerful companies in the history of the world. And not only is it just about corporate power and the accumulation of wealth and capital, it's also about labor. It's also about politics. It's also about our experiences of ourselves and our experiences of one another on a cultural level. So these forces that are optimized for commercial marketing, data analytic activity are now shaping aspects of our lives that are far more pervasive than the mere process of buying and selling products or viewing advertisements. So that's the transgression there. I think in many cases, Americans and maybe global internet users on a general level sort of implicitly made that contract or that bargain. You know, you can think what you will of it, to say, hey, you know, we're flooded with advertisements. We might as well get some advertisements that are quote unquote personalized or targeted toward us. So that's one sort of sphere of human activity. But now when those logics of computing, algorithmically monitoring, and then influencing one's experience online push into other realms of experience, into other realms of our activity, our political lives, our economic lives, our cultural lives, even our personal lives, that is a major transgression that I'm not necessarily sure, I don't think, and this book argues we have not necessarily agreed to those terms. Of course, we've signed on to those terms of service, thinking that what we were merely experiencing on Facebook or on Google or on other major platforms were more targeted economic, you know, commercial ads. But now we're realizing this is influencing us on far more deeper and fundamental levels. And these are areas I talk about in the book.
Were we duped by the social liberalism of the technocrats, you know, the founders of Google and Facebook and Twitter, who have sold us this idea that the freedom to buy what you want is equivalent to freedom itself?
Yeah, there's a notion of individual choice, the agency of the individual to explore the wild digital world in ways that were guided by the platforms. And that's very seductive, right? That is liberalism. That's seductive and that is powerful. And I don't want to dismiss the fact that some of the platforms that are put out, especially by Google, are very efficient, they're very easy to use, and they're free, right? But free as in freedom or free as in free beer? These are the questions we ask, right? So, in a sense, we signed implicitly onto a social contract of liberalism, but the liberalism only extends in a very small sphere of our lives, right? So the liberalism is the freedom to navigate, but actually the experiences of navigation are being invisibly curated for us. And what we've signed onto are all sorts of other contracts where we don't have liberalism, we don't have agency. So this book is critical of those issues, which I'm speaking about now, but this is a very important point. It tells stories about how people and organizations and activists, and even in some cases, entrepreneurs, small-scale organizations, are attempting to decentralize the governance of digital technology. They're trying to not necessarily take over the internet, but they're trying to create their own spaces for their own communities or their own activist purposes that support, at the end of the day, people and grassroots communities.
So let's talk about that. And you've long followed these issues. You've traveled around the world and met people in various communities that are, you know, supposed to be in the other side of the digital divide to see how they have harnessed technologies. How, what are lessons that we can learn from indigenous groups that have used technology, use digital technology to actually further the social justice and economic justice ideals that we want the internet to conform to?
Yeah, so first of all, this idea of digital divide is an extremely paternalistic term. It assumes that people around the world just can't wait to caught up and, you know, get iPhones and get, you know, on the cloud, which is basically a Western corporate dominated cloud or a Western corporate dominated kind of digital world. So it's very patronizing and paternalistic. And it's something that I critique in this book. Basically, it's the idea that they just can't wait to catch up to live the lives that we live. So instead of seeing the world in that way, I'm interested in what experiences of connectivity and access might look like when imagined and created and self-determined by communities themselves. And so with indigenous communities, which I write about in quite some detail in this book, in the first full chapter of this book, you actually see a whole other idea. There are terms that are hijacked in our world, like innovation or design. But actually, innovation and design and creativity often come from people who have less, right? They have constraints. So when I have constraints in my world, I have to innovate within them. I have to figure out solutions that work for me. Not when I have this sort of seeming abundance of infinite resources, as we see in R&D laboratories that are extremely decadent in Silicon Valley. So indigenous communities, I give examples of how these communities are often the most forgotten, the most ignored, and highly objectified when it comes to digital divide efforts. You know, they're only seen as potentially, you know, bottom of the pyramid. There are terms like last billion, bottom billion, incredibly pejorative terms that are used to describe developing world and marginalized communities, specifically also indigenous communities. So I give examples that are just really, really imaginative that are actually happening right now. For example, the largest community-owned cell phone network, collectively owned network, who thought technology could look like this, is being created, designed, and owned by tens of thousands of indigenous peoples in the Oaxaca region in Mexico, in southern Mexico. This is happening right now, yet we don't pay attention to this. We just simply think about, you know, the new model of the iPhone or perhaps even these traumatizing issues around surveillance. These are examples of community agency. So I give examples in this book of how various communities, especially indigenous communities, want to preserve and maintain their traditions, their voices, their values, and they see a value for digital technology when it's localized in the context of their own self-determination. The term we use is sovereignty in the book. Mm-hmm. They want to take power over technology, its ownership, how it's managed, who it serves, what percolates around it, and most importantly, where the data goes. So this is what's happening in this book. I'm describing these examples, and I'm actually not talking about digital technology, kind of new technology, if you will, but also how this all comes out of examples like your own programs, you know, community radio. You know, community radio has given birth to community indigenous digital projects that I describe in the book, like this project in Oaxaca.
Now, Ramesh, the innovation that you describe by people who, you know, I have to work with less. Is that the kind of technology that you feel the big corporations like Google are threatened by? I mean, are these big enough to actually make some of these corporations nervous?
Probably not. Sadly to say, I think they're seen as sort of informal economy, marginal examples that at the end of the day don't challenge the levels of scale and returns on economies of scale by which these companies operate. However, if you see these examples as lessons that maybe all of us can learn from, that we don't simply need to throw away, you know, an iPhone 7 to get the iPhone 8, or I don't even know what number it is these days. And, you know, these ideas of planned obsolescence, right? So actually, we see some evidence that our tools are designed for us to die so that we have to buy a new tool, meaning phones, for example. And that often when we throw these things away or discard of them, they end up in landfills in places like West Africa or in Haiti. So this kind of consciousness is unfortunately absent. I don't think it's because people don't care. I think it's because people don't know. So if they see these remarkable examples of digital networks that are more mindful, They're more self-determined. They're more based on principles of community. They're more civically engaged, right? These are alternatives for technology. And I'm not trying to fetishize or, you know, put on a pedestal these early kind of counterculture hippie networks that were associated with the internet. You know, I mean, we still see some like stragglers of that today, like Craigslist, which has its own sort of cadence or resonance with
this. Craigslist is amazing. They have resisted putting ads, and they do brisk, you know, informal bargaining and buying and selling. It's a pretty amazing example of what could be.
A community-oriented network, a place-oriented network, yeah. One where data about us is not gapped, captured, and monetized in ways we don't understand. Yeah. One where data about us doesn't just transgress economic transactions, but our political and personal lives. One of the more important points I make in this book is that on a very fundamental human level, as human beings, we should have control over our own lives. Like who I am right now speaking with you, Sonali, is different than who I am when I'm like walk out this room and hang out with my brother, which is different than who I am when I teach my classes at UCLA. I should have control over my own personal identity, but my identity is now being controlled by the data that I'm leaking out and that is being pushed back at me that is then influencing my mind and my activity, right?
Right, so Google is trying to map out who you are by taking your past behavior and curating your every experience on the internet so that in the end, you end up in an echo chamber of your own creation.
In a way that we have no understanding, right? Especially as these devices become closer to our bodies and our homes, right? Yeah. Google Home is literally a great example of this, or the Amazon version of this. So this is, you know, my identity is partly in relation to who I'm talking to, what time of the day, you know, how I feel, where I am. And I want to, at the minimum, be able to have the opportunity to be who I am as I choose to be. But as all these forms, if I'm leaking data out 24/7 and all that data is being kind of computed and pushed back out me, anytime I look at my phone, anytime I go online, and then I know and we know that that influences our cognition, then this other identity about ourselves, which is aggregated rather than disaggregated, is now influencing our lives. So this has profound effects on a very, very human level. So on that level alone, I feel people should find what's going on objectionable. We should demand for social responsibility from these companies. This is incredible, but I'm literally speaking at Google next Monday. We'll see how that goes.
Really?
We'll see. You know, you got to talk to everybody, right?
I mean, absolutely. Well, they need to hear from, if they need to hear from anyone, it would be someone like you. So let's talk about how, you know, the smartest people, the smartest tech people in the world don't all work in Silicon Valley, don't all work for these tech companies. Some of them are, as you write in your book, hacktivists, the Edward Snowdens of the world. How has their work, and a lot of it life-risking work, people have paid a big price for trying to subvert the locks and the gatekeeping in the internet to make things truly free for us. How much prospect is there for more such hacking in the future, or is it becoming a very fortified place?
Great question. The biggest threats to this global, opaque, big data, ultra-capitalist system that we see around us in the making are the leak and the hack, right? So the Snowden case is an example of the leak, but it's also related to the hack as well, because these both, much more so than these, you know, community networks I describe, or these, you know, initiatives on the margin, or even informal economies, these are much bigger threats to the fundamental logic of invisible gathering, surveillance, and computing that drives, you know, the global empires of big data. That's why, if you notice, the responses to folks like Snowden, and I know he's a very controversial figure, but also Julian Assange and others, you know, remember, each hacker or hacktivist is not the same. Some of them are really problematic in many ways. Or Anonymous, of course, is a very strict approach, a very intense approach toward criminalizing and persecuting. Chelsea Manning, another example, as a leaker, as a whistleblower. So these are threats to this system, right? And so the point I want to make is that the genesis of all of this actually comes from the data that is computed and gathered and monitored, collected, analyzed, and aggregated about us. And that actually is a corporate practice rather than simply an NSA practice, right? And I want people to understand that they might, you know, that there might be a very convenient response being said, well, I don't like it when the National Security Agency collects data about me. And now we see that they've been hacked in spectacular ways as per the news last week. But it's fine to say that, but you have to understand the mechanisms by which those forms of surveillance occur are partly what we sign onto when we use, AT&T, when we use Verizon, when we use Facebook, when we use Google. And we have to be okay with deciding what we're okay with being public about. We can't simply be scared and use, you know, cryptography. We also have to decide what we're okay with being bold and public about. And that's also part of a resistance and a progressive sort of set of alternatives to what we see occurring around us. And this is really centrally important in our lives. People should pick the issue that they care more about. It doesn't have to be surveillance. They could care about losing their job to automated intelligent technology, privatized intelligent technology. That's going to happen in the next 10 years. Hmm. Pick the issue you care about and advocate for more justice. And what hacktivists are attempting to do is the simple precursor to progressive alternatives. And that precursor is just exposing the existence of this occurring, right? There, and that itself is a spectacular set of revelations, but it's necessary so that people in our public can realize what's going on and advocate as much as they can for whatever alternatives they believe in.
So finally, Ramesh, let's talk about that. Let's talk about how we can view, how we sort of can change our own lens through which we view these monopolistic digital platforms that, you know, see us as numbers and see us as potential objects of monetization. We have used quite successfully many of these platforms to reach out to one another, to organize, to, you know, make the world better. I mean, people, it's a given these days that if you want to organize and mobilize against the policies of President Trump, you would use the tools available to you online, including the ones of these problematic platforms. So rather than view them as convenient tools that we make a bargain for, what are the ways in which we can reimagine these tools as subservient to us? I mean, they really should be at our service. We are the internet.
Specifically because the language of the branding campaigns associated with many of these companies is public, democratic, progressive language, right? Think about sharing economy, bringing the world together. These are terms that are used by these companies. Don't be evil, right? These are think different. I mean, that was Apple's, right?
And just to add to my question, Ramesh, and what you were saying is also relevant to this. We hear of more and more examples these days of the most nefarious retaliation against even especially progressive activists by Facebook and Twitter. I mean, so many of my Facebook friends who are journalists or activists will say, I was just locked out of Facebook for 2 days because I reposted such and such a thing, to the point where suddenly you are cut off from the network you have cultivated by this invisible godlike, you know, person or corporation that has deemed through its bots that you violated some unknowable rule. And that's pretty powerful and dangerous.
And it's also important to note just the small example of the New America Foundation firing Barry Lynn, who was one of the main critics of Google's near monopolistic activity, a big, outspoken, and very scholarly, reputable critic of Google's activities. And this was a front page story on the New York Times, no less, not on a progressive, you know, left network, which indicated that there's a possibility that that occurred because of pressure by Google which is one of the major funders of the New America Foundation. So this is a left-leaning think tank that's supposed to be devoted to scholarly thinking. I have a lot of friends that work there, right? And this is already happening in our spaces, our academic and journalistic and active spaces. So to your question, it is at the same time important to note that they're very young, they're babies. And Facebook's just a little about 15 years. Google's around the same, a little more than that. These are babies, right? We can actually remember, I know I can, you know, maybe many of the listeners and viewers can, remember a digital world before these things existed. So what that means is they are socially and politically and economically constructed. And even if you look at Facebook 5 years ago compared to today, it was really different in many ways, not just the user experience, but the data practices and even the corporate behavior, if you will. So we can't assume that the world as it stands is the world that shall be. We can't assume it's inherently going to get better, but we can't also assume that it's inherently going to get worse if we have any voice over it. So part of our activity has to be to understand the practices as best as we can and demand more transparency as we use these platforms, right? Like I'm speaking to you on Skype. I want to know what Skype will do with my data and what it won't do. And I need to have some assurances around that and a way to, you know, stop Skype from doing things that I don't want it to do. We need to find ways to use these platforms as well as other modes of communication and ingenuity. They can involve encryption, they can work. We can also use other ways of building networks. We can also use, you know, hacking kinds of technologies. But we have to understand why we use the platforms we do. We need to understand what the contracts are more or less that we're signing onto when we use these platforms, because there's no question that the, you know, if you will, decentralized use of Facebook for a progressive cause can be very powerful, as we've seen, you know, with the Me Too example, right? And which we now seen spiral into, you know, major cycles of news stories around sexual harassment and you know, misogyny and persecution of women, right? By major celebrities, if you will. So I think that there's a real possibility around these things occurring. We need to know the limitations and possibilities of these platforms, and strategically, as people and community members and activists, use them as we see fit. But at the same time, we can't assume that simply putting something online is a form of activism. It could be pushed into a bubble. It could circulate in a chamber. It could be used as a form of surveillance against us. It could be used, you know, post factum as some sort of form of judicial prosecution against us, as we see also happening with people in their smartphones when they try to enter the United States, right? So it's always important to try to think about alternatives to those issues, like deleting the content on your phone and then getting it back on after you cross the border, which is what a lot of activists I know have been doing, and immigrants. We need to think about alternatives to all of these issues. But at the same time, in the meantime, we need to understand and learn from examples where progressive campaigns have used technologies, older or newer, some that are not even classical technologies or media technologies, to push their agendas. So that's why I tell stories in this book of the Chilean student movement, of Occupy, of the Indignado movement in Barcelona, of the Arab Spring, which I was more personally involved in. And I tell stories of how these campaigns use technologies, not by bowing to them in a naive or blind way, but kind of agnostically. They use different tools, different systems, knowing that this would work for that, that would work for something else. So it's this kind of idea that we have power. We still have power. Yes, these tech platforms are threatening that those forms of power, but at the end of the day, we can take them back, and there are a lot of ways we can actually fight back and actually, in some cases, perhaps even kind of explain to them why some of the problems that are occurring with their platforms are occurring in our own lives. And part of that is, this is sort of the most maybe benign explanation I give in the book as a former engineer. I sometimes realize that even in my own training back in the day, I would study engineering and we would only think about the social implications or even the values that influenced our design of systems as an afterthought. We wouldn't think of them as central to our design process or even our evaluation process. So sometimes the way technical education functions is actually removing all the social, cultural, and political dynamics of engineering education. And so that's something that I'm actually saying maybe there's something in geek culture which is insulated from an awareness of what all these things mean. I mean, I don't know if that's so true. I mean, that's my most benign possibility. And maybe that's something that's going to work when I kind of make those arguments next week at Google.
Well, I'd love to hear what your responses, what the responses to your talk at Google would be. Ramesh, thanks so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the interview. Appreciate it.
Ramesh Srinivasan is director of the Digital Cultures Lab and associate professor of information studies and design and media arts at UCLA. His earlier book was Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. We've been discussing his new book, co-authored with Adam Fish. It's called After the Internet. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.